The first time is the mask. The ability to make masks for oneself, the ability, as we are seeing now, to assume roles. A role in a society is a mask. Just like in tribal times, you would have a mask for your ceremonies, you have a role in society for your ceremonies. It's on an equivalence level. I always love the phrase that women use of putting on their face. I mean, when they put on their makeup, after a while, one has acquired the right mix so that the makeup comes to a certain point, one's face. Always with the wonderful consciousness, the heartfelt consciousness, this is not me, this is the face I'm putting on. This is my cosmetic. It's easier for a woman to understand than a man. For a man to understand that is really something. A man has to contort himself to appreciate that. And it's a very strange contortion for a man. His sense, his kinesthetic sense of appreciating that is that he has to stand on his head. Do you remember when you were little and you used to look at people upside down and their forehead would be where their mouth is? And you'd say, gee, you look funny. Well, that's like the child playing and understanding already, intuitively, that we're not just what we seem to be, but what we seem to be is a really important part of something else. And for a child, the emphasis is that the something else is much more worth attention than what we seem to be, so a child will play with the seemingness, whereas an adult in their ego fear will not play with themselves. Part of the loosening up process is for them to be able to temporarily assume roles. In fact, the whole sense of humor, if you read Baudelaire on laughter, he's just so tremendously insightful. There's nothing like Baudelaire to understand laughter and comedy, real insight, because he was so morose in his normal personality. He really did understand. Laughter is the ability to play with what seems to be permanent but is really only an appearance. And the play, notice the play is the very term which we colloquially use for drama, a play. And the core, the origin of drama as an artistic form is Greek tragedy. I don't know if you know this, it's the first time that there was any conscious form to this. Now there were Egyptian religious dramas like the Triumph of Horus, but they were not plays. They were very high mythic ritual presentations, but Greek tragedy is the first time that you have consciousness playing with the forms. And the first play in history is Aeschylus's Persians. For a Greek who fought at Marathon, like Aeschylus did, to a few years later to be able to write a play about it was really a triumph of consciousness. It was an incredible triumph of consciousness. It's like somebody who had been through the Battle of Iwo Jima being able to tell jokes about it a few years later. It's a very high order of humanity. And Aeschylus was the first to do it. He was the only one who could do it. Notice that what he did is he took the Dionysian goat songs of the peasant rituals of dissolving into psychic energy old forms, and he appropriated that as a vehicle for consciousness to use to dissolve old forms of animosity, Greeks and Persians, to be able to present the Persians in a humane way so that one could understand them as human beings. one takes the very energies and processes of threat against oneself in a limited way, and that becomes the very cue for the processes of healing. It's like the basic principle of Apollonian medicine is a little bit of poison will cure you. The poison will kill you, but if you take a little bit of it when you're healthy, it'll inoculate you so that you will not be killed by it. You'll be protected. The whole thing of immunization, the whole principle of immunization is always consistently this. In the psychological sense, one takes a little bit of death when one is healthful and you are inoculated against death. What is that little bit of death? The acceptance of the openness of the self and of the person and of the spirit. So that when death comes, as Cousin Zakis used to say, when death comes, I will have used up everything and he is welcome to the shell. Let's take a break. One good thing about having cassettes is that you can follow the continuity. I remember you saying during the break that if you miss a week or something, it seems that you're out of sync. If people are not in sync, they don't know that. But once you get in sync, you can see that there is an organic unfoldment going on. It's a principle that Frank Lloyd Wright said was characteristic of great art. And he said that this was continuity. Let's go to Wright. Let's see how he says this. This is from Frank Lloyd Wright, Architecture and Nature, published by Dover Paperbacks, and you can find this at Hennessy and Engels for $7.95. He's talking about the organic plan. Nature argued against perfect symmetry, except at very small scale, and suggested instead the immeasurably more fruitful principle of informal or occult balance. What is occult balance? It means that it's weighted towards manifestation. Are you saying that on really small scale, nature seems more symmetrical, but on deep consideration, one can see that that symmetry is weighted towards an openness which allows for development. There's a very famous book in physics published by Princeton about 40 years ago by Hermann Weyl called Symmetry. I have a copy up here. And the whole development of nuclear physics came around from appreciating that there is symmetry, and yet there is a kind of a symmetry which allows for an asymmetrical dynamic to occur. I have to give you an artistic metaphor for this. A dancer uses perfect poise to move. If a dancer didn't have the perfect poise, the movements would not be elegant. And in just the way nuclear physicists say, the movements of nature are elegant, because they come out of seeming perfect poise. That movement occurs in nature is a great wonder, source of unending wonder. That the symmetry moves means that reality is asymmetrical in terms of our experience of it. The movement is a part of what we experience. I hope I'm not cutting it too fine. I hope you can see that there's an appreciation. The whole fact that insight works is testimony to the asymmetricality of our experience, of symmetrical reality. Our experience is asymmetrical. The very nature of psychic energy is to play, not to remain static. The whole reality of psychic energy is that it plays, it moves. And to try and hold it into forms is the essence of stupidity. Let it play. There are strategic forms that come out of the play which allow the play to occur, so that strategic forms are more important than tactical forms. Ritual is a horizon of tactical forms. Art is a horizon of strategic forms that allow for the play to occur, that allow for creativity. The play is creativity. Psychic energy at play is creativity. And a strategic form is superior to a tactical form in that it allows the play to occur. It allows for the symbolic self to spin out and radiate and energize and come up with novel forms and so forth. There's a very deep appreciation of this by the great art critic Herbert Reed. He wrote a book called The Forms of Things Unknown. And Reed tuned his aesthetic teeth on sculpture, especially on Henry Moore. He's a personal friend of Henry Moore. And he was a friend of Jung's and wrote books on Jung and so forth. Wrote histories of sculpture. In the Bollingen series, he has a book called The Nude. I have it here in the original hardcover cloth edition. A history of an aspect of art which came out of the appreciation of tactility in sculpture. The appreciation of the nude in Western art is very, very sophisticated. For instance, in Asian art, the nude was not appreciated. And the first Asian artist to appreciate the nude was Utamaro. And it was a great leap of discovery aesthetically for him to not only understand, but to be able to then express that importance. Utamaro's nudes are just as important as Monet's landscape. It shows a cross-fertilization. It shows ethical, artistic values leaping across civilized bounds and presages a new strategic civilization, which is worldwide, which is where we are today. So right on the organic plan, this is page 41 out of Architecture and Nature, the Stover paperback, nature argued against perfect symmetry, except at very small scale, and suggested instead the immeasurably more fruitful principle of informal or occult balance. Not just metaphysically occult, although it is that, but occult in the sense of hidden balance. You don't see the balance, but you appreciate it. What's the occult balance in a building? The space of the building. The livingness of a building is its space. You can look at the walls, you can look at the windows, you can look at the detailing, you can look at the form, but you can only experience the space, and space is the occult balance of a building. That's like about 20 years ago, I was over in Pasadena at the Gamble House. I was making slides, and I was photographing the Gamble House all day, 10 rolls of film, and got into the details. And the details and everything, the whole structure of the house is built on the cloud motif, the line which, instead of being straight horizontal, has a double curve in it that allows for like a flattened cloud symbol. It's there visually, but it's there in the very structure of the whole house. And after working with it all day, I came out and I came out the knapsacks full of cameras and film and everything, and suddenly, walking across the grass in front of the gamble house down to my car, I felt like I was walking on clouds, scuffing clouds. It was like that deep psychic penetration of the symbol had gone right down into the inner balance of the inner ear and the movement of the feet, and it was, there it was. The building's space was more real than even the forms. And by immersing oneself in the building, the space penetrated into the person physiologically, and it does. The greatest house like that is not the Gamble House, although it's very close, but Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water, where after a while, it's just a mystical cascade of kinesthetic sensory experience. One feels that you are a part of the continuity of nature, which is symbolized by that waterfall. And water falling throughout your whole being is what is real. And you can come out of there, glassy-eyed, and wander off in the woods, never to be heard of again. Believe me, it's very strong. Tongues are out, as I used to say. Now, Wright rarely forced a plan into a rigid, static symmetry. Even the plan of the Unity Temple was invigorated by a dynamic relation between dominant and subordinate masses. Dominant and subordinate masses. A dynamic relationship between them. And a complex sequence of steps and turns in the passages to the seats of the great room, causing oblique and wholly unexpected perspectives. Wright liked to use 30 degrees so that the movements in a lot of Wright's buildings move at 30 degree angles. That is to say, your mind says that you're walking in a straight line, but the building is slanted 30 degrees, so actually you're walking on a hypotenuse of an imagined right angle. Your mind tells you that you're walking in grid fashion. Your body tells you that you're making diagonals. And after a while, the only way to reconcile these two dimensions is that you begin to transcend the opposition, and you begin to float. And in that floating, you occur in the space of the building. And the genius of Frank Lloyd Wright is that he makes that space happen so that when you float, you don't just transcend imaginatively, but you transcend into the arch of the building. And then is when you realize that architecture is not just construction. It's really something. As Wright said, it's the mother art. It's the way that man learns to make conscious space for himself, or to make space consciously as an expression of himself. Either way, it's true. So this quality engenders itself in seed fashion in sculpture. The tactility of sculpture is the aesthetic seed, the artistic sprout from which the space of a building can be apprehended or appreciated, as we would say. Let me read a couple of sentences from Henry Moore. This is from the Documents of 20th Century Art series, Henry Moore on Sculpture, published by Viking in these art paperbacks. I got this at Dutton's Books years ago. I imagine they still have it. Tactile experience is very important as an aesthetic dimension in sculpture. Our knowledge of shape and form remains, in general, a mixture of visual and of tactile experiences. A child learns to judge distance by touching things. And our sense of sight is always closely associated with our sense of touch. That is why a blind man learns to rely more exclusively on the use of his hands. Now, does a blind person, but when one uses hands for gestures, one is searching for the right expression, for the right phrase, and so on. A child learns about roundness from handling a ball far more than from looking at it. Even if we touch things with less immediate curiosity, as we grow older, our sense of sight remains closely allied to our sense of touch. And then it goes on in this fashion. One of the reasons I use more is I use Kandinsky is because he is a great artist who is able to express himself in discursive language also, although he didn't very much. And Kandinsky didn't very much. When they did, they were extremely incisive. They were able to do this. Notice that the sense of touch, which is so denigrated in our time, I mean, before the touchy-feely phase of the 60s, touch was almost banished from Western European civilization. Look but don't touch is what children were told. And look how impoverished the adults of such children were. Disastrous. Children must touch in order to plant the seeds of what they can then experience. They have to touch. It's the way in which the development begins. And notice that if they are given geometric forms to touch, to play with, spheres and cubes and pyramids and so on, they will have real seeds, real beginnings for a sense of strategic experience later on in life. This is the very essence of education. The way Frank Lloyd Wright was trained as a child was the old 19th century technique of a series of toys called the gifts. A German educator named Froebel, F-R-O-E-B-E-L, brought back an old Pythagorean technique of education of having primal geometric shapes in basic colors for children to play with, so that their imagination was schooled as a cocoon around these primordial shapes and colors, so that when they would normally develop and become adults, their experience capacity would be strategically open to a much greater extent. And Frank Lloyd Wright is a perfect example of such a person. His mother said that he was going to be an architect when he was conceived. And famous story that his mother used to hang these beautiful prints of the Thomas Cole English cathedrals in the room even before he was born. And people would say, why is this? And she said, he needs something to look at so that he can build these things. Right, Mrs. Wright. But he became Frank Lloyd Wright. He could think in geometricity, in space and color, just like one daydreams, just like an ordinary person mediocrely daydreams. He could think rationally in terms of geometry and colors and space. He could play in his mind's eye and see them quite clearly and quite accurately. I don't know if you've ever seen, I have the beautiful Japanese edition of the works of Frank Lloyd Wright, about $150 a volume. The volume 10 here, or 12 here, Frank Lloyd Wright in his renderings, you can see in his renderings, his architectural drawings, even in the drawing stage, he saw the building exactly, accurately, in his mind's eye. The drawings were just to manifest what was real in his mind. The same principle like for Mozart. Mozart never composed until he heard the entire piece in his mind, and then he just wrote it down. This is true even of something like the Jupiter Symphony, number 41. He heard the whole thing complete in his mind before he wrote a note down. It's incredible. It's in his letters. The protean capacity of the human person who brings the self-energy conscious is legendary. There are no limitations for such a person. The only limitations are those of time and space and opportunity, but there are no limitations interiorly. It's just like the deep self has really no limitations whatsoever. When we talk about freeing human beings, you can see that this is an asymptotic jump in freedom. It's not just freeing them to choose between a limited number of possibilities which some authorities in a culture offer to you. You can have A, B, C, D, or G. Well, you have the freedom to choose between A, B, C, D, or G. Well, but the fact is that one can be free to go outside of that whole alphabet if one wishes to. What are the limitations? One says, oh, well, you can compose music in this particular mode. Well, there are unlimited modes. There are unlimited musics. So that the whole notion of human freedom needs to be taken out of the bottle that had been stuffed into 2,000 years ago. When we talk about free human beings, we mean proteanly free human beings. As Jefferson said, our only task now is to free as many people as we can to be themselves and let them be free to choose whatever they need, whatever forms of government they need, they'll make for themselves. We don't have to worry about that. The best constitution to give them is their own being. They'll make whatever they need for their own lives. Our only task is to give them as much of a head start as we can and turn them loose. Give the future to them. And you can see that just in a few phrases, we move to really enormously important kinds of talk and language. We're not talking about revolutions. We're talking about complete restructuring. Restructuring not to some new structure, but restructuring to freedom, to openness. As Faulkner said towards the end of his life, don't worry about building a better corral. Man is not an animal that should be put in any kind of a corral, no matter how well built it is. One of our textbooks is The Archetypal World of Henry Moore by Erich Neumann, the great Jungian psychiatrist who also taught at the University of Tel Aviv. Neumann was really a mystic. In fact, one of his great essays is in one of the Aronoff's collected books on mystical man, just an exquisite presentation. He also was concerned with what unfortunately has come to be a topic, the feminine. But he was concerned with the feminine as a self-energy radiated through an ideal form. And this then, in projection, becomes the feminine. It's not a topic. It's not an intellectual topic. It's not a lecturer's subject matter. And most of the people that talk about the feminine are boring to tears and should be ignored. Moore wrote several books that you're probably familiar with, The Great Mother and Amor and Psyche, books that are available from Princeton in the Bollingen paperback. This book, The Archetypal World of Henry Moore, is his greatest work because he is appreciating from his depths that Henry Moore as an artist expressed in a protean way the feminine in sculpture, in a way that was beyond Neumann's capacity to do, but not beyond his appreciation of it. And so he writes in this way. Of the two big themes in Moore, the mother-child motif expresses not only the dependence of the child on the mother, but also that of man on nature and of the individual on all life. So there's a parallel, a triad of parallels here. The individual in life, man in nature, the child and the mother. The child and the mother is a seed of man and nature, which when freed into its ultimate is the individual and life. If one wishes to translate forms into necessarily inadequate concepts, notice Neumann catches himself right away. He delivers a very powerful idea, and then he says, but we're not talking about ideas, no matter how beautifully expressed or how powerfully expressed. Let's face it, they're still concepts. But what we're talking about is quite real and quite protean, despite the beauty of our concepts. But let's use the concepts, and yet let's look through them. It's like Antonioni, the filmmaker, used to carry around a little blank slide, and he used to hold this slide up to train his eyes so that he could compose in terms of a frame of reference. And every time you look at something, you see a goddamn slider. What are you looking at? I'm looking to look. Neumann. The reclining figure, on the other hand, is a representation of this mighty other, of the female principle in the loneliness of its self-contained existence. Now that's packing it in. The reclining figure, on the other hand, is a representation of this mighty other. The other is in quotation marks. Of the female principle in the loneliness of its self-contained existence. We have seen how the transformation of the personality of a reclining woman into the transpersonality of the Earth Mother was expressed by her recumbent body changing from the organic into the recumbent inorganic body of the landscape. In the 1933 reclining figure, the mountain peaks of the two breasts correspond to the precipices of the knees, and the reduction from the human scale is indicated by the melting down of the head, which as the emblem of individuality has dwindled to a knob-like or bulbar process that only functions as a formal quality. The motif of the head, its melting down as well as its enlargement beyond what the head normally signifies, plays an important role in Moore's work. It is as if the emotional accent affected this part of the body more than any other. When, in the works so far discussed, the accent lies on the body, on its formation and transformation, then the head gets smaller. Notice the kind of opposition, head and body, mind and body. And notice that as one diminishes, the other grows. But notice that the diminishing of the one, the compacting of it, the other grows in a way which reflects the distortion. As the head shrinks and compacts, the body grows but becomes less compact, becomes capable of spaces, which were nascent in it but not revealed before, until the head is just a knob-like, but the body is filled with cavernous space, so that if the head were reduced to a pinpoint, the body would vanish into space. Notice the tension in a Henry Moore sculpture to not let that happen, and yet to approach it as close as one can sometimes. So that there is a dramatic tension in Moore's work, which when one gets sensitized to, begins to startle you, because you realize these works are not ritual masks, but they're artistic creations of a personality. It took someone to experience this precariousness, this dynamic, this incredible revelatory compensation, and still be able to work with it. Many people have been destroyed by just fractions of that kind of realization, that kind of tension. And many people would just fall apart and say, I can't take it. Moore not only took it, but worked. And notice that the medium that he worked with, characteristically, metal and stone, the hardest things that he could find. But when he played with plaster of Paris maquettes. We called them maquettes. Why? Because his maquettes were all small, they would fit in the palm of the hand. Moore's studio, characteristically, had no windows. Not because he was ignoring nature, but nature was too much with him, as the Victorians would say. He had skylights. Okay, you can, the sky can come in, but let's have a little balance here. No windows. And instead of windows, the walls were covered with shelves, and on the shelves were bits of nature. Bone, stones, interesting shapes from every kind of thing, so that nature was represented, not represented, represented in the artist's own selection from his lifetime. So his creative activity took place in this transformed nature, literally and physically. The maquettes were small enough to work in with the palm of the hand. They were never larger than that. I always used to get the sense that these little Moore maquettes were like his cuneiform. Cuneiform tablets were always fit the palm of the hand. Remember this morning about grasping knowledge? Well, the old ancient Sumerian, Akkadian use of language, written language, was always in the palm of your hand. The idea of being able to use a sheet this size to put written language on shows a transformation of consciousness of a protean level. Are you kidding? Just the consciousness of moving from the scroll to the codex was a quantum jump in the confidence of the personality. It's one thing to face written language in that dimension, it's another thing to have an open book. Even the symbol of the open book it still carries a kind of a wallop. Well, 2,000 years ago, when that transformation happened, that was really something. The first person to use codice, book form, constantly was Cicero, the second half of the first century BC. But he only did it for his own personal value. The cuneiform clay tablets fit in the palm of your hand. There are some at the Philosophical Research Society, original ones. Moore's maquettes were like this. They were all small like this. And as long as he worked in that size, as long as he worked in the palm of the hand, he could work with plaster of Paris. He could build it up, or he could scrape it off. He could soak it and make it more pliable, or could achieve a certain temporary firmness. But when he went to make sculptures, when he went to project this out, Then you had to have steel or granite or real hard wood. You can't work with materials that won't take the tension. Part of it is emotional. Part of it is realizing that this tension will split anything else. And maybe we better work with steel this time. Working with steel is very difficult. My neighbor next door is a sculptor and works with steel and is building a 40-foot sculpture in Pasadena at Lake in the Freeway. And it's taken him years just to be able to work up to that scale and that size with that material. It's one thing to work with little nibblers and a little bit of steel, but to work with 40 feet of steel is really something else. It takes a lot out of you, which you have to have, otherwise you run a deficit. More is like this. Neumann writing about Moore. So that the head, when it gets smaller, the body gets more and more into space. But when, for whatever reason, the emotional accent falls on the head, then this organ, as we shall see, becomes a world that is independent of the trunk, and even starts leading a singular existence of its own. Whereas the mother-child motif was, quote, spiritualized, in a way typical of the trend towards abstraction, the transformation of the reclining figure during the same period follows a different course. Notice now that we're linking Moore with Kandinsky. Kandinsky, the first development of abstract art. Not just that he was the first or the pioneer, but he's the one that made abstract art conscious. In this book, Concerning the Spiritual and Art, published in 1912. This book does for art what Einstein's theory of relativity did for physics. It establishes that someone has made conscious the entire ecology of the pattern of not only that process, but appreciating and living in that, on that level of manifestation. Kandinsky is really somebody. Moore also, and in sculpture, moves towards this abstraction, not too much later. 20 years later is not too much time at all. The transformation of the reclining figure during the same period followed a different course. Here, too, there is an accentuation of the structural, mathematical element, as is particularly evident in the sketches for unexecuted works. But we also find in the years when Moore was experimenting with abstract art, this is in the early 30s. We'll wait for these. Am I straining you too much? Are you getting exhausted?